Part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. We were scheduled this afternoon to speak with forensic anthropologist Clea Coff, the author of The Bone Woman. We've had to postpone that interview until Thursday, June 3rd. So this afternoon we dip into the archives and we rebroadcast an interview with age studies scholar Margaret Morgenroth Gallette. This is an interview from March 22nd of this year. What do we think about getting old, about aging? Where do our ideas, our attitudes about getting older come from? We take up these questions with age studies scholar Margaret Morgenroth Gallette this afternoon, a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Center in Brandeis University. At Brandeis University, she is our guest today. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. In her new book, Aged by Culture, Margaret Gallette notes that we develop our ideas about aging through the process of socialization, a process that begins in childhood. All well and good. But Gallette says in America and elsewhere, the narrative spun in the culture about aging is about decline. Think back to when you were a child. Getting older meant getting taller, learning new skills and the like. But that changes, doesn't it? As Gallette writes in Aged by Culture, we find ourselves being sold on rejuvenation. Why else do we face midlife crises and buy rejuvenating toothpaste? Gallette says if aging really equaled progress, younger people would be tattooing wrinkles on themselves or highlighting their hair with gray. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In addition to Aged by Culture, Margaret Gallette is the author of Declining to Decline. Her essays have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and The Nation. Her new book, Aged by Culture, is published by the University of Chicago Press. Margaret Gallette, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's really my pleasure, Celeste.
Sure. To start, would you tell our listeners about the exhibit you saw at the Boston Museum of Science and its significance?
Well, yes, because that made such a shocking difference in the whole structure of the book and my thinking about age culture. You said rightly that we develop our ideas about age and being aged in childhood, and I had been taught by my mother that I was going to progress in my life course, that I would heal, that I would grow, that I would earn higher wages when I got older. And when I went to this Boston Museum of Science show, it was a special exhibit called Secrets of Aging. And there was one booth that the children were going to, and it took a photograph of them, and then they could press a button that was like a VCR remote, and it would show them, it purported to show them, how they would age year by year from, let's say they were 15, from 16 through their 60s. And everything went wrong. I mean, as they aged, what they saw was that they got redder, they lost their hair if they were boys, they got terribly lined, they got spots all over their faces, and they found the experience quite dreadful, and they sort of fled from the booth. But I interviewed a bunch of them, and they were saying, in effect, we don't want to get old. And I felt that this was a sign that decline was backing down the life course in American age culture. Much younger, it was hitting much younger subjects, attacking much younger people than any of us who call ourselves age critics had ever thought. And the whole Secrets of Aging show had gerontologists vetting it. So I thought, well, my goodness, our decline culture has really gotten under the radar of even these very perspicacious people. So that was very depressing and interesting, and it did make me change the writing of the book.
Yeah. Do you think, while on the one hand we're anxious about aging, we're rushing children to grow up?
Yes. Yes, there is a phenomenon that I call speed up that I think we can see in some aspects of the way child rearing has changed. I mean, at one extreme, we have New Yorkers trying to buy their way into special preschool programs for their children that will supposedly get them into the college of their choice, which will then supposedly give them, you know, a better chance, better life chances in terms of the job market. But those are some of the super rich trying to do that. But I think many parents feel that, and I think this is the reason for speed up as it affects childhood, I think many parents feel that the market is so risky now that they can't just, you know, hope to give their children a college education, that they must really position them in a much more careful way than even my age cohort positioned ourselves and was positioned by our parents. It's just too anxiety-producing.
Yeah.
And I think that age anxiety and work anxiety very much overlap in our culture.
Yeah. In reality television shows, they call it the reveal. Would it be fair to say that messages about aging are constantly revealed to us no matter what our age is?
Well, I think that that is true. And I think anybody who is familiar with ads, for example, magazine ads, TV ads, or films, notices that there is a kind of, that the people in the ads are very, very young. And the people who produce the ads are very, very young. and that has an interactive effect. I mean, as we become more obsessed by age in this country, we also become more obsessed by our own cohort. And we are expected to identify with our own cohort in a more tenacious way, to the exclusion of engaging more with other cohorts. So I think that's one reason why we see why youth is actually, rather than what we usually mean by the term age, youth is revealed by these ads. And in fact, when there was a time when you were seeing what is called Generation X and only Generation X in ads in the 1990s, and it was as if it was this strange world in which there were no children, and there were no midlife people, and there were no post-retirement people. There were nothing but Xers, and they were playing games, and they were also anorexic.
Hmm. Well, you know, yesterday, as over the course of the weekend, I'm reading your book. Yesterday, I'm looking at the paper and the circulars. We still have pretty much the same situation. There are kids in the ads. There are people of an age to have children, that's about as far as it goes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, and there is a TV station, you are reaching me in Newton, Massachusetts, there's a TV station in Boston, and I would say that not less than once a week, they have some kind of infomercial, that is, it is supposedly information, but it's also intended to be entertaining, about some new product or device for rejuvenation. It was some sort of laser skin treatment, and I feel that it's really incumbent upon me at some point to write to them and point out to them what they are doing by this, which is to reinforce our notions that there is something wrong with us, because we have wrinkles, And I hope that, you know, the people who have been hearing me in the Boston area will also start doing this sort of thing, because I do want to get people into a more activist mode. I do want them to believe that there's something that they can do about this, that we just can't, you know, talk about it on talk shows and wring our hands and say, oh, my goodness, tisk, tisk, what's going on with our culture? That's really not going to be enough.
Yeah. Well, that's one way to fight the idea of, you know, age is decline, is to speak out and to write a letter and that kind of thing. But also it goes much deeper than that because, you know, we have so many assumptions. I mean, how often do we, you know, toss something off like, I don't know, like you mentioned a number of things that we might hear in the course of a day about forgetfulness or aging or something like that. It is deterioration. It is decline. And and we just, it just goes right over us, right through us. It doesn't, we don't question it. But
well, going right through us, that seems to me a very poignant way of putting it, because a lot of our age comments and conversations around the water cooler and so forth are very jocular. People who forget something, not if they're young, but if they're older than young, will sort of laugh it off as a senior moment. And I'm going, well, now, what happens when a young person forgets? Are we going to start calling that a junior moment? I mean, this is, and I don't want that to happen, actually, because I don't want there to be, I don't want us to keep reinforcing the fact that memory loss is somehow age-graded. I mean, a lot of what scholars know about memory indicates that very little of it has to do with age grading. I mean, your junior high school kid is going to forget to do his homework or her errands, and that is not what is typically called age graded forgetfulness. And I think we do two things. We confess various age-related things that are going wrong with us. Women in particular, I think, do this, but men do it more and more often, too, and they do it even in writing. They point out that, you know, they're wrinkled, or they point out that they had an accident on the squash court, and everybody's joking about their having become middle-aged. Well, you know, you could have an accident on the squash court at 22, and it wouldn't be appropriate to make those jokes. I don't think it's appropriate if you're 38, which is as young. I mean, you can have an accident on the squash court as young as 38 and have somebody say that to you. So I think you're right, Celeste, that people are producing this for one another.
Hmm. Now, as more people are living into old age, are we seeing any signs of a change in our attitudes about aging?
Well, I think that there has been some remarkable progress for older people, post-retirement people with disposable income. And I'm happy about that. I'm happy that they can talk about, and they do talk, when they come to my talks, they want to tell me about new options in retirement, new work in retirement, new interests, healthy aging in retirement, and so forth. And that is great. I guess a couple of things that don't coordinate very well with that bother me. One is that you have to have disposable income, quite a lot of disposable income, before you become one of these privileged seniors. So that's one problem, which is a problem about class. Who gets a good old age in America? But the other thing that I've alluded to already that scares me, I guess, even more, is this: the way that these "you are aging, you are declining" messages keep hitting us younger and younger. A couple of years ago, I started learning that about preventive facelifts, and 40-year-old women were getting preventive so-called facelifts. I mean, that means they scarcely have any lines in their face at all. And recently, I've been hearing about 30-year-old men getting calf implants, and I was on a TV show, and the 23-year-old woman who was doing my makeup for me, her sister was saving up for cosmetic surgery in her 20s. So we can boast about longevity and health. In fact, I think we do that all the time. Well, the commerce in aging is backing down the life course more and more, and it's striking younger and younger people with the fear of aging past youth.
Hmm. Some years ago, I remember being in a store, and I would say I was quite young at the time. I hadn't been in the workforce very long.
Mm.
And I was wondering about a particular piece of clothing, and I thought, I don't know. And the young woman who was not all that younger than I was said, well, all the young girls are wearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I thought,
right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, I think that actually fits in with the speed up that we were talking about earlier, that the, and it's interesting, it's in the whole history of women's fashions. If you go back to 1900, women's fashions, the hourglass figure, was very popular and very fashionable. And if you were a midlife woman who had had children, you were allowed to wear, if you were middle class or above, you looked very good in the fashions of that time. You were allowed a big, deep décolletage, you know, you could show some cleavage. You had a narrow waist that was corseted, and you had wide hips. And your teenage daughter would want to look like you, and she wouldn't be allowed to yet. She wouldn't be allowed to wear as much padding. And also, she'd be a skinny teenage girl, and she wouldn't just look mature and handsome the way her midlife mother looked. And so you can see how much that has changed now, because the midlife woman is getting asked to... Well, she's getting asked to wear something that shows her belly button. And, you know, really there are very few girls over about 15 who, you know, really do, I think, want to show their belly button.
Hmm.
It's just, I don't know if you see that in Urbana very much.
Hmm. Yeah, I would say it's definitely a very young thing. And occasionally... while going through some television stations in the afternoon here while we're looking for a particular news update or something, we'll run across MTV.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty amazing how at once the girls look so old, but yet they are so young.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the most modish age is probably between 13 and 17, and we know that those little beauty queens in between 3 and 8 are made up, that they wear lipstick and mascara and rouge, and they are supposed to look like, well, we used to say they're supposed to look like women, but in fact they... Now they look like teenagers wearing a lot of makeup. I mean, I sometimes think, well, that, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you could have sort of show the belly button but have a fleshier sort of region in there, that might be a better, if we had a little more flesh on our bodies, if we were allowed to have a little more flesh on our bodies.
Mm.
You could have a sort of a belly dancer belly and still be considered really attractive. You wouldn't have to be a skinny teenager. I mean, this is age here overlaps with the beauty myth, which is this, you know, you can't be too rich or too thin.
Hmm. So at one end we have a speed up, and then, you know, then we hit a certain age and we start to get the message that aging is something to be camouflaged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when do you think we get that message? I mean, those young women who are between 13 and 17 who are the optimal now, apparently, When do they get the message, and when do they begin to act on the message that they should be camouflaging some things?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it differs very much, it probably differs very much from urban to rural, and depending upon whether you're on one of the coasts. I think New York and L.A. are probably worse. I mean, we have to realize that not every adolescent gets the same message, and there are families that are more that in which they protect their children better. They try to, at any rate. And there are subcultures in which children are protected better from this need to get into, think about rejuvenation, so to speak, young. But, of course, the big problem happens once you get out of your family and once you get into the workforce. And as soon as you get into the workforce, you are going to get a double set of messages, and one of them has to do with the fact that your bosses are going to be a little bit older than you, or a lot older than you. So you see that there is something called age hierarchy in the workforce, and that is, I think, reassuring. We want to be able to tell progress narratives about the life course at all ages, and we want this progress narrative to go on and on and on as long as it can. But I think in many work situations, you see that, in fact, midlife people are not doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't see it, you may well hear it from the business press or even from the mainstream press reporting something that the business press has either discovered or thinks it has discovered, which is that this urban myth that a younger person can't get a job unless a midlife person loses one. The most devastating myth of our time.
Hmm. Well, once upon a time, we valued experience. You talk about an experience premium, but it has declined.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us some more about today. What is the value of seniority?
Well, I think our culture ought to value seniority much more than it does. And I think that what we call the American dream is based on seniority, speaking in the broadest terms about what that might mean. In other words, there are seniority systems. They exist in the university. They exist in school systems. They exist in the army, and they exist in government work. And then there are less structured seniority systems elsewhere in the workforce. And these systems make possible for all of us the increasing life course benefits as we age into the middle years. And I still think that this is quite a durable expectation. It's the basis of the American dream. The American dream is actually, it's not so specifically about getting a house. It's not so specifically about putting your children into college. More generally speaking, the American dream is a life course story about progress. You are making progress as you get older. And you're going to have a little bit more power, and you're going to have more authority, I mean moral authority, a good kind of authority, not the ability to dominate other people, but you're going to have authority as a teacher or a coach or a parent or a godparent and so forth. So all of this these are the benefits that we look forward to, that we want our children to look forward to if we're old enough to have children or we do have children. And that's what I fear is at risk in American culture now.
Hmm. That's pretty dramatic. That's pretty significant to think of a real change in that idea of the American dream, that particular story in the culture.
Yes, it is. And it's and I think it's an untold story. I think it is a fear that that nobody has quite put their finger on yet. And I think that people who think about their own life course, and they feel that some sorrow or unhappiness that they may not be able to get something in the future, because they are thinking consciously or less consciously that they are too old. I think that it can be in any different area. It can be in love or the hope of, you know, sexuality, or the hope of a better job, or a raise, or more self-esteem, or growing respect. We can fear that we are not going to get these because we are too old. But I think one of the messages of my book, which is not intended to be grim, although I do sometimes feel like Cassandra amidst the joggers, is that you are not alone if you feel this way, that this is, that America is having a midlife crisis, if you will, that many, many people are feeling this kind of age anxiety, and that there is plenty that you can do to unite, to not make it a private story. We just cannot allow ourselves to think that this is just my story, or just the story of my friend, or just the story of those people down the block. We have to think that this is something that age culture is doing to us, and that we could do something to prevent it, or to prevent it from getting worse.
Age studies scholar Margaret Morgenroth-Gallette is with us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book is Aged by Culture, published by the University of Chicago Press. She's a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Center at Brandeis University. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y. This is a way, this is something that makes it difficult to see ourselves collectively, isn't it?
Yes.
It's wedge demographics.
I think this new age cohort, the demographic now means an age cohort. More often than it used to. I mean, a demographic could be your gender demographic, your race demographic, your ethnic demographic, and so forth. And now I think age has been added to all of these, and it's a very divisive addition. And you know, you can call people, you could call them the midlife generation, and that would be an age demographic. But it wouldn't have the same force, the same divisive power as naming them something like the boomers or Generation X. And the difference is that it's very hard to describe, quote, the midlife generation in a way that becomes a stereotype. But the boomers have definitely come to be a stereotype. Quite a while to get it there, and it took big exertions on the part of the business press. But the business press hated the boomers, I guess, from the time they were considered the 68ers. Although, as you may recall, not everybody in the so-called boomers was a 68er. I mean, some of the quote boomers in 68 were, you know,
kids.
Barely born.
Yeah.
The end of the boomer generation was born in 1964. So some of them were 4 years old at the time of 68. But at any rate, the boomers got this imaginary biography, which was that they were long-haired hippie freaks who then sold out and became the sort of the dominators of culture. They rule the media. They focus all the attention on themselves. Well, I just don't think that that can possibly be true, because if I ruled the media and was a boomer, I certainly wouldn't want to be described the way the boomers get described. So I just think there's some disconnect here that we haven't been picking up on. And the Xers have gone through an interesting set of changes, too, but because they started off as slackers in 1991 at the time of the recession. The business press, picked up later by the mainstream press, called them slackers because it was their fault that they couldn't get jobs. That, of course, overlooked the recession. But the worst thing, I talk about this in a chapter called The Contrived War Between the Xers and the Boomers.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing about constructing these stereotypical age cohorts was that it pitted them one against the other. And that's how the myth about this job myth, that you can't get a job, a young person can't get a job unless a midlife person loses one, that's how it came into circulation, because the press was saying, well, the boomers don't really deserve all the advantages they've gotten. They don't deserve their perks, their dental plans, and so forth. As these plans were being cut from jobs, people were saying, well, you know, it's because the boomers don't deserve them. But that didn't make any sense to me. I'm sure it didn't make any sense to many people, because you younger people would want a dental plan too. I mean, and they might think that they deserved it. So, but they, of course, were less likely to ask for it. And in fact, my argument is that Xers and boomers and the war between them explained job loss in America in a way that made it seem that there was nothing that you could do about it, when, in fact, there probably is quite a lot that we could do about it. We could start off by being very indignant.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the role of anger here in just a second, but before we do, I want to talk with you a little bit here about a cartoon that you write about in the book that I think sums up the meanness of this us against them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It cuts right down into the family. Roz Chast, a cartoon where she suggests some contemporary Father's Day cards for today's dad.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Where the child is, you know, really hitting dad hard, you know. I mean, dad's the slacker now, you know.
Right. There are cartoons about unemployed dads and sons, only sons, not daughters, and sons who have jobs. And there's this sort of, the sons are, in the cartoon, gloating, pretending to be helpful, you know, maybe I'll get you a job now, dad, and so forth. And Chast was not endorsing this, but
right. She
had certainly picked up on something that was going on in the culture. And this was 1997. So it was, the boom was still going on. The depression, the recession, it's gone on so long for some people, I'm sure they think it's a depression. The recession was 3 years in the future. But it's curious. What Chast seems to have picked up on in the intuitive way some artists can be is that there was a change in the premium for experience. You mentioned that earlier. The premium for experience is the amount that people in their middle years earn than entry-level workers. So, in other words, if you join the workforce at, let's say, 20 or 22, you get an entry-level salary in whatever your job course is, and then you look ahead to people in their middle years, and you say, oh, look how much more they earn. Okay, that's my future. Maybe I'm starting off low, but I'm going to just really do so much better by the time I'm that age. Well, in the 60s and 70s, that was a big jump. It was like 22 to 30% more than the young people were getting. And it's been steadily declining. And at that very period, about 94 and 99, the premium for experience went down more because, partly because younger people were earning so much more. Not all of them, of course, that's never true, but just the ones who were earning so much more raised the average in the way that happens. And midwife people were not getting the premium for experience that had been historically true. So it's just an interesting coincidence of that the cartoon should have come out while that was happening, in the period when that was happening. But it was scary to me because I thought, well, you know, if you can lower the premium for experience in a boom period, then, you know, then it could just be permanently lowered. I mean, nothing is ever permanent exactly, but the trend could be that there is not so much premium for experience. And in fact, some of those, there are some hints in the economy that it's not there for midwife people so much anymore.
Yeah. Well, we're the crummiest generation. That's another Roz Chast cartoon.
Really?
Yeah. It wasn't.
It
came on the heels of Brokaw's bestseller, The Greatest Generation, and you know, suggesting that the greatest generation's children, those of us in middle age, are the crummiest generation.
Well, that fits with everything that I'm talking about, doesn't it?
It sure does.
With denigrating the boomers because. Because you want to push them out of the workforce. I mean the capitalism wants to push midwife workers out of the workforce because they are believed to cost more than their productivity. Now, I think that's very hard to prove and probably untrue, but the belief can drive a lot of personnel managers. It can drive the CEOs, who, of course, are also among the crummiest, but seem to be doing very well economically. I wish they would have a little bit crummier life chances, if that would help the rest of us get ahead a little bit more in our middle years and help our children get along in their middle years.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to have an adult son, so when I say our children, I am speaking from that point in the life course.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we can do, I guess, is get angry. And what was it, the film a number of years ago, Patty Chayefsky, I'm Mad as Hell and I'm Not Going to Take It Anymore, Network, that play, that film. I want to talk with you about anger because it is in the culture, and I wonder if we shouldn't be making some use of it. Yesterday in the paper, a columnist was asked, we hear so often about angry people, road rage, sky rage, rage in the workplace. Where is all this anger coming from? And, you know, as I had been reading your book, I'm thinking, well, you know, age anxiety has got to be playing a role here. And you get enough things stacked up, it's like Thanksgiving weekend at O'Hare. You know?
Yes. I mean, anger can be very fruitful, or it can be very destructive. And I think that there are a number of possible responses to feeling that you are aged by culture, and they have a little bit to do with how conscious you are of what's happening to you. I think age anxiety can be a depressive feeling. And it can reduce your ability to even help yourself. So I would like for people who are learning that they are suffering from age anxiety to move on to the next phase and begin to feel outraged and indignant, which are various forms of anger that have a moral or an ethical component. That is to say, you're sociologically astute. You know something about where the anger is coming from, or rather, what the causes of your anger are. And then I think you want to move on from anger into collective action. Now, we have many grassroots organizations in America that are working on some of the issues that I talk about in this book. I mean, we have union building movements. We have movements that want to maintain tenure. We have movements that want to prevent corporations from going overseas and dragging our American jobs with them. We can work. We have civil rights movements that could add age to their agendas, because midwife discrimination is a frightening and a powerful obstacle to our telling progress narrative in the middle years of our life. And I think that political action is a very good way to go. Can I give one example?
Sure. First? Go ahead.
The Supreme Court decided in the year 2000, the same year that I went to the Boston Museum of Science show, they decided something called Kimmel, a case called Kimmel versus Florida Board of Regents. And in that decision, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote for the majority, and I'm going to quote here, "States may discriminate on the basis of age. A state may rely on age as a proxy for other qualities, abilities, or characteristics that are relevant to the state's legitimate interests." Well, that made midwife discrimination at the state level legal. Now, but that doesn't mean that all the states followed Florida in you know, whatever they were doing. It happened to be about tenured faculty in Florida. And if anybody knew about Kimmel, I've done a book tour, and I every time I mention Kimmel, I say, has anybody here ever heard of Kimmel? And only one person has. So I think we need to know, you know, a great deal more about what is happening in age culture than we do. But once we know that, we can fight at the state level against attempts to reduce seniority among state employees, for example. We should know that many of us, I suppose, do know that the Department of Homeland Security was set up with employees having lost some of the seniority benefits that other government employees have. But I don't think people realized when they learned that one out of 12 employees of the federal government in Washington is in the Department of Homeland Security. So I don't think people realized what was at stake. The unions tried to explain, but because we didn't have a knowledge about age culture, because we didn't have the language to talk about age culture, because we couldn't hook it to these losses in midwife wages and seniority, it didn't take somehow. People couldn't get hold of it. And I think now, you know, at least I'm hoping that with my book, they'll be able to understand how all these multiple things are interconnected. It's not just the commerce in aging, and it's not just the age, you know, the midwife discrimination laws, and it's not just the workforce, but it's all of them interacting together. It's the corporations, it's capitalism, and it's us around the water cooler.
Hmm. This area of study that you're involved in, age studies, is it a field that is receiving some attention, more attention?
Well, I think so. I think that more people are willing to identify themselves with it. I named it only in 1993, and I felt we needed a coinage that would be sort of the equivalent of gender studies or critical race theory, which had been extremely interesting, provocative, and useful terms around which people coordinated. And I do see more and more people, you know, setting up conferences. They want to call them age studies. They want to do issues of magazines and journals and call them age studies. And I think it will actually come into the culture even before there are things like majors or programs or interdisciplinary scholarly things at the university level. You know, it seems to me that people will just use it. But how fast it will grow, you know, of course, I don't have a crystal ball on that. I would hope it would be very fast. I mean, this is an election year, and a lot of the issues that I'm talking about are policy issues. They're policy issues that the Democrats will be talking about. And I think that they should add age, and in particular what's happening to the midlife workforce, to their considerations and to their and adjust their policy orientations in a way that would make sense of some of these discoveries.
Margaret, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Celeste. It's been a wonderful interview.
Margaret Morgenroth Golette has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a resident scholar at the Women's Studies Center at Brandeis University. Her latest book is Aged by Culture. She's also the author of Declining to Decline, her new book, Aged by Culture, published by the University of Chicago Press. And that interview from March 22nd of this year. Again, we were scheduled to speak with forensic anthropologist Clea Koff, the author of The Bone Woman. That interview has been rescheduled for Thursday, June 3rd. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. And on the fifth day, they rested. At least that's the way it seems at the Chicago Board of Trade. Although they traded quite a little bit in the bean pit this afternoon, futures did finish just 3.5 cents higher in the July. That's a new number. And in August at 3.5 cents lower. I got to tell you, though, if you look at the weekly charts on the lead option from the expired May contract last Friday at noon, which is now new, the July lead option to this Friday's settlement price, beans dropped about 96 cents. We'll take that up with Mike Zuzulo this afternoon during the closing market report. And with Jerry Gahlke, by the way, tomorrow morning on Commodity Week at 11:30 Central Time here on AM 580. Let's take a look at how the settlements came across from the board in the grains floor. July futures for the wheat, 374. The high and the low at 365 and a quarter. A settlement price there at 368 and a quarter down to September 381. The high, the low at 373 and a quarter. And a settlement price at 376 and a half, down 1 cent for the day. December contract in the wheat pit, 390 and a half, the high, the low at 383. A settlement, 385, down 2 3/4. And March futures, 393, the high, the low at 390, settled 393, down 2. And the May contract, 391, the high, the low, and a settlement price all for the May wheat, 391, unchanged for the day. In the corn pit, some interesting formations in the charts. I'm sure you probably heard Dave Dickey and Mike Zuzulo talking potentially about that head and shoulders top in the corn. We'll take that up again this afternoon with him. July futures, 293 and 3/4, the high, the low at 287 and a half. And a settlement price there at 290, down 2 1/4 for the day. September futures, 287 and a quarter high, low at 281 and 3/4, settled 284 and 3/4, down 0.75 cents. December contract in the corn, 284, the high, the low at 278, settled 281, down 1 1/2 in the March futures, 288, the high, the low at 283 and a half, settlement price there at 286, down 3/4 for the day. May contract for the corn, 290, the high, the low at 287 and a half, settled 290, they were off 0.5 cents. And July, 291, the high, the low at 287 and a half, settled 288 and 1/2, down 1 for the day. September futures for the corn pit, 278, the high, the low at 276 and a half, settlement price at 277 and a half, down 0.5 cents. And the December futures for 2005, 269 and a half, the high, the low at 268, just a penny and a half, trading range settled on the low at 268, unchanged on the day. July oats, 149, the high, the low at 142, settled 148 and 3/4, they were 4 1/2 higher, and the September's ended 4 3/4 higher at 154 and 3/4 in the oat pit. July futures in the bean pit now, 880, the high, the low at 852. They had a pretty good size trading range, but settled just 3 1/2 cents higher at 872 and a half for the day. August contract, 820, the high, the low at $8.5, settled 812 and a half, down 3 1/2. September, 738, the high, the low at 722, settled 728 and 3/4, down 3 3/4. And the November beans, 688, the high, the low at 678 and a half, settled 684, up 1 on the day. January futures, 688 and a half, high, low at 681, settled 684, they were a penny and a half higher, and the March contract 685, the high, the low at 677, settled 685. They were up 2. The May contract ended the day unchanged at 676 in the bean pit. July bean meal, 286, the high, the low at 276.50, settlement price at 282. They were down 30 for the day. And the August meal, 270, the high, the low at 261, settled 265.20. Down 60 for the day. July bean oil, 291, the high, rather 29.10, the high for the day. The low at 28.25, settled 29.05. They were up 40 in the August, 28.40, the high. The low at 27.62, settled 28.37, up 38 on the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Livestock prices higher today on the Merc. May feeder cattle, the high 105 even, the low 103.80, the settlement 104.92 and a half, that up 102 and a half. August 105.80, the high 103.80, the low 105.35, the settlement, that up 110. September feeder cattle, 104.35, the high 102.15, the low 104.35, the settlement, that up 147 and a half. June live cattle, 83.67 and a half, the high, 82.65, the low, 83.45, the settlement, that up 47 and a half. July live cattle, 87 even, the high, 86.50, the low, 87 even, the settlement, that up 25. August live cattle, 86.10, the high, 84.95, the low, 86.02 and a half, the settlement, that up 90. June lean hogs, 76.10, the high, 74.65, the high, 75.45, the settlement, that up 130. July lean hogs, 75.80, the high, 74.55, the low, 74.70, the settlement, that up 77 and a half. August lean hogs, 74 even, the high, 73.40, the low, 73.65, the settlement, that up 67 and a half. October lean hogs, 62.67 and a half, the high, 61.77 and a half, the low, 62.52 and a half, the settlement, that up 70. Bellies today, the high 122.90, the low 121.50, the settlement 122, even that up 115. The Dow up 45 points at 99.83, the NASDAQ 9 higher at 19.06, the S&P 500 up 5 points at 10.94.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Edward Harvey from Venice Beach, California wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, if I let a helium balloon go, how high will it go? Will it go to the moon?
It depends on how high you are at the time you release it. Since you say you live on the beach in Southern California, you may be way out there already, high above the Van Allen belts. Your balloon would only have to be blown a